Chapter 19. The Villa Straylight was a parasitic structure, Case reminded himself, as he stepped past the tendrils of caulk and through Marcus Garvey's forward hatch. Straylight bled air and water out of Freeside and had no ecosystem of its own. The gangway tube the dock had extended was a more elaborate version of the one he'd tumbled through to reach Haniwa, designed for use in the spindle's rotation gravity. A corrugated tunnel, articulated by integral hydraulic members, each segment ringed with a loop of tough, non-slip plastic, the loops serving as the rungs of a ladder. The gangway had snaked its way around Haniwa. It was horizontal, where it joined Garvey's lock, but curved up sharply and to the left, a vertical climb around the curvature of the yacht's hull. Malcolm was already making his way up the rings, pulling himself up with his left hand, the Remington in his right. He wore a stained pair of baggy fatigues, his sleeveless green nylon jacket, and a pair of ragged canvas sneakers with bright red soles. The gangway shifted slightly each time he climbed to another ring. The clips on Case's makeshift strap dug into his shoulder with the weight of the Ono Sendai and the Flatline's construct. All he felt now was fear, a generalized dread. He pushed it away, forcing himself to replay Armitage's lecture on the spindle and Villa Straylight. He started climbing. Freeside's ecosystem was limited, not closed. Zion was a closed system, capable of cycling for years without the introduction of external materials. Freeside produced its own air and water, but relied on constant shipments of food, on the regular augmentation of soil nutrients. The Villa Straylight produced nothing at all.
"Mon," Malcolm said quietly, "get up here side me."
Case edged sideways on the circular ladder and climbed the last few rungs. The gangway ended in a smooth, slightly convex hatch, 2 meters in diameter. The hydraulic members of the tube vanished into flexible housings set into the frame of the hatch.
"So, what do we—"
Case's mouth shut as the hatch swung up, a slight differential in pressure puffing fine grit into his eyes. Malcolm scrambled up over the edge, and Case heard the tiny click of the Remington's safety being released.
"You the man in the hurry?"
Malcolm whispered, crouching there. Then Case was beside him. The hatch was centered in a round, vaulted chamber floored with blue non-slip plastic tiles. Malcolm nudged him, pointed, and he saw a monitor set into a curved wall. On the screen, a tall young man with the Tessier Ashpool features was brushing something from the sleeves of his dark suit coat. He stood beside an identical hatch, in an identical chamber.
"Very sorry, sir," said a voice from a grid centered above the hatch.
Case glanced up.
"Expected you later, at the axial dock. One moment, please."
On the monitor, the young man tossed his head impatiently. Malcolm spun as a door slid open to their left, the shotgun ready. A small Eurasian in orange coveralls stepped through and goggled at them. He opened his mouth, but nothing came out. He closed his mouth. Case glanced at the monitor. Blank.
"Who?"
the man managed.
"The Rastafarian Navy,"
Case said, standing up, the cyberspace deck banging against his hip.
"And all we want's a jack into your custodial system."
The man swallowed.
"Is this a test? It's a loyalty check. It must be a loyalty check."
He wiped the palms of his hands on the thighs of his orange suit.
"No, mon. This a real one."
Malcolm came up out of his crouch with the Remington pointed at the Eurasian's face.
"You move it."
They followed the man back through the door, into a corridor whose polished concrete walls and irregular floor of overlapping carpets were perfectly familiar to Case.
"Pretty rugs," Malcolm said, prodding the man in the back. "Smell like church."
They came to another monitor, an antique Sony, this one mounted above a console with a keyboard and a complex array of jack panels.
the screen lit as they halted, the Finn grinning tensely out at them from what seemed to be the front room of Metro Holographics.
"Okay," he said. "Malcolm takes this guy down the corridor to the open locker door, sticks him in there. I'll lock it. Case, you want the fifth socket from the left, top panel. There's adapter plugs in the cabinet under the console. Needs Ono Sendai 20-point into Itachi 40.
As Malcolm nudged his captive along, Case knelt and fumbled through an assortment of plugs, finally coming up with the one he needed. With his deck jacked into the adapter, he paused.
"Do you have to look like that, man?"
he asked the face on the screen. The fin was erased a line at a time by the image of Lonnie Zone against a wall of peeling Japanese posters.
"Anything you want, baby," Zone drawled. "Just hop it for Lonnie."
"No," Case said. "Use the fin."
As the Zone image vanished, he shoved the Hitachi adapter into its socket and settled the trodes across his forehead.
"What kept you?"
the flatline asked, and laughed.
"Told you don't do that,"
Case said.
"Joke, boy,"
the construct said.
"Zero time lapse for me. Let me see what we got here."
The Quang program was green, exactly the shade of the TA ice. Even as Case watched, it grew gradually more opaque, although he could see the black-mirrored shark thing clearly when he looked up. The fracture lines and hallucinations were gone now, and the thing looked real as Marcus Garvey, a wingless antique jet, its smooth skin plated with black chrome.
"Right on,"
the flatline said.
"Right,"
Case said, and flipped.
"Like that? I'm sorry,"
3Jane was saying as she bandaged Molly's head.
"Our unit says no concussion, no permanent damage to the eye. You didn't know him very well before you came here?"
"Didn't know him at all,"
Molly said bleakly. She was on her back in a high bed or padded table. Case couldn't feel the injured leg. The synesthetic effect of the original injection seemed to have worn off. The black ball was gone, but her hands were immobilized by soft straps she couldn't see.
"He wants to kill you."
"Figures,"
Molly said, staring up at the rough ceiling past a very bright light.
"I don't think I want him to,"
3Jane said, and Molly painfully turned her head to look up into the dark eyes.
"Don't play with me,"
she said.
"But I think I might like to,"
3Jane said, and bent to kiss her forehead, brushing the hair back with a warm hand. There were smears of blood on her pale jalaba.
"Where's he gone now?"
Molly asked.
"Another injection, probably,"
3Jane said, straightening up.
"He was quite impatient for your arrival. I think it might be fun to nurse you back to health, Molly."
She smiled, absently wiping a bloody hand down the front of the robe.
"Your leg will need to be reset, but we can arrange that."
"What about Peter?"
"Peter."
She gave her head a little shake. A strand of dark hair came loose, fell across her forehead.
"Peter has become rather boring. I find drug use in general to be boring,"
she giggled.
"In others, at any rate. My father was a dedicated abuser, as you must have seen."
Molly tensed.
"Don't alarm yourself."
3Jane's fingers brushed the skin above the waistband of the leather jeans.
"His suicide was the result of my having manipulated the safety margins of his freeze. I'd never actually met him, you know. I was decanted after he last went down to sleep. But I did know him very well. The cores know everything. I watched him kill my mother. I'll show you that when you're better. He strangles her in bed."
"Why did he kill her?"
Her unbandaged eye focused on the girl's face.
"He couldn't accept the direction she intended for our family. She commissioned the construction of our artificial intelligences. She was quite a visionary. She imagined us in a symbiotic relationship with the AIs. Our corporate decisions made for us. Our conscious decisions, I should say. Tessier Ashpool would be immortal, a hive, each of us units of a larger entity. Fascinating. A player tapes for you, nearly 1,000 hours. But I've never understood her, really. And with her death, her direction was lost. All direction was lost, and we began to burrow into ourselves. Now we seldom come out. I'm the exception there.
You said you were trying to kill the old man? You fiddled with his cryogenic programs?
3J nodded.
I had help. From a ghost. That was what I thought when I was very young, that there were ghosts in the corporate cores. Voices. One of them was what you call Wintermute, which is the Turing code for our Burn AI, although the entity manipulating you is a sort of sub-program.
One of them? There's more?
One other. But that one hasn't spoken to me in years. It gave up, I think. I suspect that both represent the fruition of certain capacities my mother ordered designed into the original software, but she was an extremely secretive woman when she felt it necessary. Here, drink.
She put a flexible plastic tube to Molly's lips.
Water, only a little.
Jane, love, Riviera asked cheerfully from somewhere out of sight, are you enjoying yourself?
Leave us alone, Peter.
Playing doctor. Suddenly Molly stared into her own face. The image suspended 10 centimeters from her nose. There were no bandages. The left implant was shattered, a long finger of silvered plastic driven deep in a socket that was an inverted pool of blood.
Hideo,
3J said, stroking Molly's stomach.
Hurt Peter if he doesn't go away. Go and swim, Peter.
The projection vanished. 075840, in the darkness of the bandaged eye.
He said you know the code, Peter said. Wintermute needs the code.
Case was suddenly aware of the chub key that lay on its nylon thong against the inner curve of her left breast.
Yes,
3J said, withdrawing her hand.
I do. I learned it as a child. I think I learned it in a dream, or somewhere in the 1,000 hours of my mother's diaries. But I think that Peter has a point in urging me not to surrender it. There would be Turing to contend with, if I read all this correctly, and ghosts are nothing if not capricious.
Case jacked out.
Strange little customer, huh?
The Finn grinned at Case from the old Sony. Case shrugged. He saw Malcolm coming back along the corridor with the Remington at his side. The Zionite was smiling, his head bobbing to a rhythm Case couldn't hear. A pair of thin yellow leads ran from his ears to a side pocket in his sleeveless jacket.
Dub, man, Malcolm said.
You're fucking crazy,
Case told him.
You're okay, man. Righteous dub.
Hey, guys, the Finn said. On your toes. Here comes your transportation. I can't finesse many numbers as smooth as the pick of 8 Jean that conned your doorman, but I can get you a ride over to 3J's place.
Case was pulling the adapter from its socket when the riderless service cart swiveled into sight under the graceless concrete arch marking the far end of their corridor. It might have been the one his Africans had ridden, but if it was, they were gone now. Just behind the back of a low padded seat, its tiny manipulators gripping the upholstery, the little brawn was steadily winking its red LED.
Bust a catch,
Case said to Malcolm.